the skyscrapers were now. He'd come into a familiar dream without remembering it was his until long after waking. But the mariner's exam. He looked back to it. If the questions were not multiple choice, he'd be screwed. The compass heading. The true heading. What? Compass error? Variation? Magnetic dip? Deviation? He liked the sound of magnetic dip, and indeed vaguely remembered Jerry's having said something about magnetic lines of force not actually being parallel to the Earth's surface, making the compass needle jostle up slightly in the northern hemisphere and jostle down in the southern. Maybe the jostle is the dip. Magnetic dip, therefore. Good enough. He was just lighting his cigarette when he saw a shadow fall across the glass panes of the door, and he looked up. He glimpsed a figure in tan moving away from the door. The docks here were given over to the day boats and rarely saw activity on Sundays, so he was curious. He placed his cigarette in the ashtray, rose, crossed to the door, and opened it. There, to his right, staring at him, was a woman in round, rimless sunglasses, wearing a loosely belted tan trench coat and a blue beret from which black hair curled down over her ears. She looked so unlike the turbaned, black-cloaked, short-haired woman of the cloisters that it took Kavanaugh a moment to recognize Rachel Vadette. A leather bag was slung over her shoulder. She was holding in her two hands, as if to fend him off, a white envelope. "My goodness," Kavanaugh said. "Miss Vadette." He heard the leap in his voice and only then felt the full surge of his surprise. She had never struck him as stylish, yet in this ragtag working boatyard, she seemed a figure nearly of glamour. "I am sorry," she said. "I did not expect..." It's all right. It's quite all right," Kavanaugh said. "I'm glad to see you. I almost didn't recognize you." She removed her sunglasses and held out the envelope. "I meant only to leave this for you." He did not take the envelope. He said, "For me?" "A letter." "How did you find me?" She glanced at the sign above the door, Kavanaugh Tug. "A tugboat captain. You told me your brother was a tugboat captain in Staten Island. You told me you would go to work with him." Kavanaugh grinned. "I did?" But then he remembered. "God, that's right. You were the first person to whom I spoke." Spoke of what he was doing. After a moment, he added, "That's so long ago. But even before I left Inwood, you left the museum." "Yes. I am a teacher now. I teach French to girls." "Ah, good," Kavanaugh said, nodding. Then he said, "I went to the cloisters once, asking for you. I owed you a lot. I thought of trying to track you down, but then realized you probably didn't want that." "That was true." She hesitated, and he sensed her need to make a decision whether to explain. To his relief, she then added, "But the months passed. I realized that I, too, owed a debt to you." Now she pushed the envelope toward him again. He took the letter but made no move to open it. "I thought on a Sunday," she said, "the office here would be closed. I did not expect to see you." "How did you get here?" She pointed up the waterfront. "The famous Staten Island ferry," she said, welcoming the neutral subject. "For 5 cents, an ocean voyage. I often come and go just for the salt air. It surprised me when I finally looked for you that you were nearby the crosser, le traversier, which I regard as my luxury liner." She almost smiled, saying, "Of course, whenever I see the great ships being turned by the tugboats, I think of you." Kavanaugh laughed. "No, Now, we push scows around the harbor, barges, workboats, not the SS America, too fancy for the likes of the Kavanaughs. She nodded. I remember. She stepped back. I meant only to put my letter here where you would find it. I will go now. He gestured with the letter. What's it say? She shook her head. May I read it? Then we could talk. Look, come on inside. It's a mess, but I have coffee on the hot plate. Will you have some? She shook her head. No, but she did not move. Kavanaugh stood aside, opening the way for her. Please, he said. After a moment's further hesitation, she went into the office. He pulled the door shut, moved a stack of tech manuals from Betty May's chair, and pulled it free of the table. Shall I take your coat? No, I will be only a moment here. Rachel sat. Kavanaugh poured a fresh cup of coffee and topped off his own. This is rotten, he said, but it's hot. He handed the cup to her, and pulling his own chair out from behind the desk, closer, he sat. He reached for the ashtray to stub out his still-smoldering cigarette. Indicating her envelope, he checked again. Should I? She shrugged. Why not? It will embarrass me, but why not? Her tone of voice was matter-of-fact, sure. While you read, she reached into her coat pocket for her own cigarettes and went about the business of lighting up. Kavanaugh opened the envelope and removed the letter, a page of neat handwriting. Dear friend, he read silently, I was une femme incomplète when we met, an incomplete woman. I remain so. But one does not begin to amend oneself until one understands. One does not understand until one speaks. I spoke to you. As you know, it was a matter of importance. You listened to me. It was enough. In these months, I have come to see as a gift what to you must have been a mere passing encounter. I am obliged to offer this word of thanks. I am in a new place. So, I see, are you. Good luck to us both. Rachel Vedette. Below her signature was an address. Hoboken. Kavanaugh looked up. It wasn't a mere passing encounter to me. You could have no idea. Kavanaugh was suddenly choked with feeling. I had been waiting a long time to change my life. Then I walked into the cloisters that day, after years of ignoring the place. It was like coming out of dark woods into a sunlit meadow. Not the cloisters itself, but where I got to. Rachel stared at the tip of her cigarette. He said, If you are in a new place, it must be a good place. You seem better. He took in her appearance more closely. Her legs were crossed. She was wearing a brown skirt that came to her calves, and black fabric shoes with rope soles. Her ankles struck him. Though she was lean as before, the hint of emaciation was gone. There was a shadow of gauntness in her cheeks still, but only a shadow. Under the sleeve of her belted coat, he saw the edge of a shirt cuff and thought of her wrist. He gestured with the letter. The matter of importance, he said. I am glad you told me. She raised her eyes to his. I wrote my address on the letter just there. Yes, I see. Hoboken. We pick up Lackawanna barges there twice a week. I was meaning to leave it for you to decide whether to reply. I was thinking that if you did reply, perhaps we could meet briefly. Then I was going to give you something. So here we are meeting. Something I would not just leave. She glanced about the office. That is, I had to be certain you would receive it. Kavanaugh smiled. Well, here I am. After a moment, Rachel stubbed out her cigarette in the ashtray and reached into her bag. She brought out a book, and Kavanaugh recognized it at once. The leather-bound antique, Historia Calamitatum, Eloise et Abelardi Epistolae. She offered it to him. Your father's book, he said. Yes, the time is here for me to leave it behind. I would leave it with you. Instead of answering or reaching to take the book, Kavanaugh turned toward his desk and pulled open a drawer, from which he withdrew a book of his own. The same book, also antique, also in Latin, also bound in leather but without gold leafing. He held it out side by side with Rachel's volume. I found it in a used bookstore off Washington Square. You taught me to treasure their letters, as you did. I still treasure it, she said haltingly. Rachel's breath caught, and she clutched her book back to her breast, nearly overcome. Tears flooded her eyes, but did not overflow. She had a rigid grip on herself. It fills me that you found your own copy. She stopped, nearly overcome. Then she went on. After I spoke with you, I realized how this book had become the signifiant, the signifier, of my father's Abelard, as if I could still complete his work. But with you I saw that my father himself was what mattered. This book, I mean, embodied my distraction, a mistake I could not correct. It was too late. It is never too late, Kavanaugh said. But immediately he understood the callowness of his remark. He placed his book on the edge of the desk, taking her misery fully in. But he was also aware that her blurted explanation was triggered by his having produced his own copy of the Abelard and Eloise, which hit her like an open sesame. The book itself was the key to the deep mystery, the Ali Baba's cave, of both their lives. He dared not say more. But what he'd said was enough to display his shallowness. Never too late. Christ. It was as if she felt obliged, but without malice, to rebut his glib statement. Still hovering on the edge of tears, she said with forced calm, I spoke to you when we sat on that bench near the cloisters. Words that began my, what to call it, reckoning. I have continued it in these months, a drastic reckoning. But in speaking to you that day, I did not say the worst thing. I had not said it yet to myself. In the face of her silence, and only because he sensed her need, he found it possible to ask, Will you say it now? I denied my father. That is it. I denied my father. He was motionless. At the end, in Drancy, she continued. She held her book to her chest as if it were a life buoy. They were taking him away. They would have taken me. I said I was not his daughter. Her sobs came finally, but she spoke through them. I do not know why I said that. Not for life, because I was only living for him. Not for fear. I was afraid only for him. It was just. The German asked me, Was I his daughter? I said no. No. I do not know why I said this. I do not understand. It was a lie with no purpose. I had always been asking, Who am I now? And at last that was the answer. A daughter without loyalty. The German did not even believe me. She was speaking in a rush. She rushed on. He shot my father dead because of me. But already I myself had done the worst. The German knew that. It was his triumph. We were alike. He was happy at my betrayal and let me live. He was right. Living was worse. After that, far worse. She stopped. Kavanaugh knew better than to think that this fresh, visceral flood of admission had anything to do with him. She had come to the point of having to put this horror into words, that was all. That he, Michael Kavanaugh, was the recipient of her expression was incidental. She collected herself enough to go on. I carried this book with me everywhere, as evidence of my first betrayal, how I had failed to see what threatened, encouraging him in what kept us in jeopardy. Abelard was a friend to Jews, perhaps, although to us at the end, he was just another dangerous Catholic. But then came this, my second betrayal, and it was mortal, literally, since in the next moment, Papa was killed. So I carried the book as if Abelard and Eloise would absolve me if only I clung to them. In the camps, in Paris, where I could not possibly live again. In coming to America, in living inside the fantasy world of that museum in your parish, I could not face the truth that there is no absolution. I said in my letter to you, incomplete woman, I almost wrote, unforgiven woman, non pardonnée. But, Miss Vedette, if I may... He was asking permission to say what was in his mind. She did not offer a signal, and so he did not speak. She repeated the phrase, non pardonné, and then continued, but here is the surprise. Did I have found it possible to live precisely as that, unforgiven? In these months since I met you, I have begun to accept that there is no forgetting. I am who I am. I did what I did. There is no undoing. This book had become to me what it became to my father, but for a different reason, a book of wishes I need no longer entertain. Therefore, I will leave it behind. Kavanaugh took a breath and realized it was his first in some moments. Rachel Vedette seemed to have finished her explanation, but he wasn't sure he understood. He felt the burden of his own recognition, but was afraid of expressing it. Rather than speak, he took a pair of cigarettes and lit them, offering one to her. It was a gesture he had made on that park bench when it had seemed inappropriately intimate. Now it seemed right, and she took the cigarette. After exhaling, she said more calmly, "Yet because it was my father's, the Historia et Epistolae remains a treasure. When I first took the Staten Island ferry, I thought I would drop it into the sea and have done with it that way, but I could not. After all, I first came to Staten Island because you mentioned it once. Having thought of you, I saw what to do. I would give my father's book to its new friend. But then seeing just now that you have your own copy of the Historia, completely surprises me, undoes me. What a companion you are to Abelard and Eloise. It made me think for a moment just now that we must be alike. Was your father there, nearby? Yes, in the line of prisoners, but he would not look at me. Did he hear you when you said no? Kavanaugh was speaking carefully. Yes, she answered. And still he did not look at you. No, it is how I know he was hurt, betrayed. Is it possible his refusal to look was his protection of you? If he looked, they would know for sure you were his daughter. If they did not know, They would not take you. Was that his purpose? Rachel considered this. Yes, she said, perhaps. Kavanaugh said quietly, cautiously, if your father did not want them to know you were his daughter, how was it betrayal when you denied it? You were doing as he wanted. He wanted you to live. Even so, she shook her head brusquely, dismissively. What I said was unforgivable. It does not matter what my father thought. Unforgivable. I knew that as soon as I said no. So did the German. The German condemned me to live with that knowledge. He was right. Kavanaugh had spent more than a decade as a facile dispenser of forgiveness, and he realized that that was what he had just attempted to do now. Better, he realized, to utter the separate truth he'd come to, even at the risk of being misunderstood. But, about to say miss again, he stopped. Instead, he said, Rachel. He waited. She did not indicate that his use of her name was wrong. He continued, there is something else besides your experience of that situation. Perhaps something larger. What? The situation itself. Who created that? Not you. Not your father. The German certainly did. But not even he was acting out of a vacuum. You said before that Abelard, even despite himself, was a dangerous Catholic, just another one. There's the point. None of what you went through, including the loss of your father, would have happened but for Catholic teaching about Jews, 20 centuries of it. I, myself, in that sense, am a dangerous Catholic. The crime you described, what requires pardoning, was not yours. In a way, it was mine. She stared at him. An amazed expression had come over her face. Don't misunderstand, he added quickly. I know the crime was Hitler's, and the crime was that German officer's with his gun. He, they, were the murderers. But someone handed them the loaded gun. What I've understood is we did that. We, followers of Jesus, we have been, what to call it, the gun loaders, the arms suppliers, maybe. The Germans could not have done what they did without what went before. You referred to this with me. The French Catholic support for Vichy. Where did that come from? And among the things I learned from you, and I guess that means from your father, is that with Abelard, the story could have gone another way. You told me this, and now I get it. Abelard marked a fork in the road, the church's wrong turn. Wasn't that what your father saw? The dangers in our theology? Yes. Kavanaugh picked up his copy of the Historia. Peter Abelard gave the great warning and thanked God for him. But as I read them, it was Eloise who made the difference to me, he said. Not just because she pushed him to become the hero he was, but because she herself so heroically refused to live with illusions. All her railing against convention, against the church even, I see it now as being about the underlying truth she saw. I have come to my small version of that. Until I met you, I was terrified of facing up to the unreality of my situation. Because as a Catholic, I knew that ordination to the priesthood is forever, an indelible mark on the soul, my solemn vow, broken. Quitting the priesthood is an unforgivable sin, for us, truly unforgivable. He paused, aware of not having said this to anyone before, acknowledging the breadth and depth of his offense. But then it hit him. How trivial his problem was, how pathetic. He said again, "Don't misunderstand, I am not comparing my situation to yours. I know they are incomparable. I am only trying to explain why I came to treasure this book you brought me to, why once, finally, I did leave the priesthood. I then haunted used bookstores looking for my own copy. These people," he held the volume up, eyeing it with more feeling than he knew he had. "That woman, actually, her. She exposed the lie that I'd built my life on. Yet Eloise could denounce it, not against the church, but within and for the church." He stopped. He said quietly, "Because I believe in God, the God I have from the Catholic tradition, I am still a part of it. But perhaps I am a Catholic now in the way Eloise was. I haven't left the church. I have only moved to the edge, as she did. She is the gift you gave me." He waited for Rachel Vedette to speak. She said nothing, but her gaze, fast on his eyes, did not shift. She knew before he did that his thought was not complete. Her silence was an invitation to go on, even if his thought would now extend to her. He said, "And one more thing, speaking of non pardonner. I am only now seeing this, but wasn't Eloise defined by her status as unforgiven, and how she accepted it? Her unforgivable offense, of course, as she saw it, was not against the church or God, but against the one she loved, for whose, yes, calamitous fate she accepted responsibility. Is it that you, in the acceptance you describe, have become like Eloise, not as a Catholic, of course, but exactly in being the Jewish daughter of your Jewish father?" Seeing the gleam of recognition in her pooling eyes, a further permission, he continued, "Being like Eloise, ironically, requires you to let go of what she wrote. Is that it? You are still instructing me, Rachel. You want to give me your father's book, not to be rid of it, but because you are finished with the task it came to represent. Forgive me if I presume, but hurts need nursing, you said, until they are gone." "No," she said, "not gone. Until they are different." She brought the back of one wrist to her face to wipe it dry of tears. Her sleeve was no longer bound with an elastic band. He saw her scar. She said softly, "Your Eloise, perhaps, is like my father's Abelard, a screen on which to flash images of the world as we would have it." Kavanaugh laughed. "Whoa, speaking of the rejection of illusions." Rachel smiled faintly. "So you are like my father. And because you are, le voilà." She reached her book out to Kavanaugh, who took it and paired it with his own. He said, "I will accept your book, but only as its safekeeper. One day it will no longer be what you called it, a signifier. It will be only what it is. And then perhaps, if you will have it back, I will return it to you." She gave no indication that she heard in what he said the implication of a future. She stood and fastened the belt of her trench coat. "So now I will go. You have been kind." She cut herself off, and he realized she'd almost called him father. She said, "From the start, you have been kind. I am grateful." He stood. "Hoboken, you said." "Yes. I told you, we go there twice a week. Let me take you." She did not understand. "If you go by ferry, then the subway, then the bus," he said. "What's that, 2 hours on a Sunday, 3? I can have you at the Hoboken dock in half an hour." He reached for his jacket. By boat? She asked. The Catherine Marie, named for my mother. It's right outside. I can use the log time. He gestured at his mariner's exam prep. I still need another 30 hours at the helm for my mate's license. You'd be helping me. We'd document the trip as vessel inspection. He laughed and led the way. At the midpoint between Staten Island and Hoboken was Liberty Island, and as they drew abreast of it, Kavanaugh pulled the throttle back. The engine noise eased off. Rachel was sitting on the jump seat beside him. There she is, he pointed through the glass of the wheelhouse, in all her glory. Seen up close, the enormity of the green statue was what registered. The day of my arrival, Rachel said, she was lost in fog. But when we finally saw her from the rail, people around me wept. Not you? No, I never weep. When she looked at Kavanaugh, she was blushing. Her face still showed the slight smear of tears. She smiled. She teased herself by adding, never. Me neither, he said, laughing. But he thought of that day they'd seen the SS America off, when a departing girl had cried down to Rachel, I love you, and he'd mistaken snowflakes on her face for tears. He gestured at the water around them. This marks the actual mouth of the Hudson. Some days, when I'm logging time, I go upriver a ways, past the bridge. Have you ever seen the cloisters from the water? No. Would you like to? She did not reply at first. Then she said, no. I've left that behind, too. No, thank you, Michael. She fell silent. Epilogue. If there is anything which may properly be called happiness here below, I am persuaded it is in the union of two persons who love each other with perfect liberty, who are united by a secret inclination and satisfied with each other's merit. Their hearts are full and leave no vacancy for any other passion. They enjoy perpetual tranquility. Mother Eloise looked up from the page, script in her own hand. These were words she'd written to him 3 decades ago. But what struck her now was the one word, happiness. Peter was long dead, and as she well knew, she was soon to follow at last. She was propped up on the pallet she'd had brought into the chapter house 2 days before. The stolid room was serving as her vestibule of darkness. Because it opened on her beloved cloister garden, she would spend her last hours within sight of the earth's most precious corner, amid the paving stones, just inside the arched ambulatory, was the marble disc carved with the letter A, the marker of his grave. 20 years before, she had chosen that spot on the path from garden to sanctuary, so that the nuns, with heads bowed on the way to choir, would see his place and then carry him, with chanted psalms, to God. While her good sisters had prayed for Peter Abelard all these years, she had been praying too. Mother Eloise realized that someone was standing in the Gothic archway, waiting. The crane-like form was familiar. Sister Celestine, the novice mistress. She had been acting as provisional superior, since Mother herself was stricken. It was certain, such was the esteem in which the sisters held her, that Celestine would be the successor abbess. Celestine was Eloise's intimate friend. Dear sister, Eloise said, and she let the vellum page fall into its folds. The novice mistress came forward. At the edge of the pallet she bowed. "Bless me, mother. You are blessed beyond any blessing I could bestow." The nun was carrying a flagon and a cup. "This is lemon water, mother. You should drink." She helped Eloise to sit forward and put the cup to her lips. Sister Celestine then placed the flagon and cup on the nearby table, beside a bowl that was alive with steam. She adjusted the white draperies of the bed, even as Mother Eloise tugged her veil back into place, saying, "There is vanity still in a wizened old nun." "Your vanity, mother, is justified. You are ever beautiful." "Still vain." She held the page up to Celestine. "Put this back with the compendium, sister. You have tended to the compilation as I asked, the codices, scrolls, manuscript leaves, all of it?" "Yes, mother. When I have replaced this missive, the lot will be sealed in the iron-bound chest and secured in the groin of the tower vaulting." "And registered in the scriptorium?" "Yes, mother." "And the dialogue with the Jew in particular, noted in the Index Reserved?" "Yes, mother." "I depend on you, sister. And I will depend on your successor when the time comes. See to the fast keeping of Master Peter's writing, one abbess instructing the next in perpetuum. I depend on you," she repeated, but now breathlessly. She had kept his writings intact across the most dangerous decades, through the frenzied destructions that followed King Louis's mad crusade, the requisitions imposed upon Cluny after the ascent of Bernard, the savage assaults against Jews wherever they clustered, and the heresy hunts launched throughout France by the ever-threatened Italian popes. Again and again the white-robed zealot monks had stormed the gate of the Paraclete, but Eloise had kept it barred. If Peter Abelard's writings could be held safe through these bloody years, why not forever? Sister Celestine pressed her beloved mentor's arm. She turned to the table and from the steaming bowl took a cloth and squeezed it free of warm water. She applied the cloth to the brow of the abbess, who lay back, eyes closed, soothed. Yes, her promise to the abbot primate long ago was kept. Her promise to Peter. His thought preserved until new thinkers could join him in it. More absently now, as if entranced, Mother Eloise said, "I just read of happiness, a word that once came glibly from my pen. Happiness for me now consists of two gifts, both coming from you. The first is that protection of his work of which I just spoke. The victory of the wicked will be reversed when men sing of Peter Abelard, who in the church of darkness pointed to the way of light. Men will curse our age for the devils it set loose, a stampede of devils against which Peter Abelard stood alone." "Not alone, mother," Sister Celestine ventured, but quietly. "Protect his writings, sister, so that the future can redeem this past." "Yes, mother, you have my vow, I understand." "Peter Abelard," the voice of Eloise faltered, "will yet help Mother Church to recover herself." "But you said two gifts for happiness, mother. What is the second?" "Master Peter's marker." "Mother?" "The marble disc in the pavement." "Yes, mother." "Side by side with the letter A, have the mason carve the letter H." Sister Celestine said nothing to this. Eloise continued with mustered strength. "Open Peter's grave, Have it ready. When my requiem concludes, have each sister approach the bier and bless me with a kiss. Then carry me to Peter. Eloise stopped. She clutched the edge of her bedgown and pulled it aside, baring her breast. Her fingers went to the gold ring, nestled in the hollow of her throat. Take this ring from its cord. Place it on my finger. Remove my habit. Unclothe me fully. Place me naked in the grave with him, to his left side. You will find that he is laid out with his feet to the east. Align my feet likewise, so that when the Lord Christ comes on the last day, Peter and I will be together for the universal resurrection, our mortal bodies made immortal, lifted up as one body in the Lord. Sister Celestine's ear, by now, was near the mouth of Mother Abbess. So softly had she been speaking. The silence that came over Eloise then was absolute. This is James Carroll. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Cloister. This program was directed by David Rapkin, executive producer Juliana Wilson, text copyright 2017 by James Carroll, production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC, all rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.